Shooting oneself in the foot is donor-imposed bureaucracy turning civil society organizations into malfunctioning machines. I understand the Obama administration is looking for failures in development, but I submitted this to a partners meeting for the Office of HIV/AIDS a few weeks ago, and they didn't take it up, and it is a failure. They said they didn't get any failures. This is one. What I'm talking about this morning is a combination of work that I did myself for my doctoral dissertation at the University of West Indies in management studies, which I finished over a decade ago, and which looked at seven organizations through their, from the time they had been founded to that period. So many of them went right through the Cold War period. And it was very qualitative research, and I'll explain that here. But what provoked me to bring this up again is last year I did an assessment, a pre-award assessment of seven civil society organizations in Côte d'Ivoire, using a very different methodology, and I found a lot of the same crap, if I could use a French word, was still going on. So I'm going to talk about those two kinds of experiences here. In Haiti, I was working with seven national or multinational organizations. I mean, in Haiti and the Commonwealth Caribbean, English-speaking Caribbean. So they were, four of the seven were multinational organizations, and the others were national in scope. They were either non-governmental organizations or semi-autonomous government organizations or quasi-governmental. They were all working in the health sector, different aspects of the health sector, and providing some kind of benefit to a constituent population. The seven were doing things in pharmaceuticals. The Caribbean Regional Epidemiological Center has over 20 country members. Health sector reform issues, the Jamaica Family Planning Association, Caribbean Environmental Health Institute. So they had different funding agencies. This is, as I said, part of this was through the Cold War. So four of them were primarily getting their money from the American government, but others were getting money from the Germans, from PAHO, different sources, so multi-donors. In Côte d'Ivoire, we had seven civil society organizations. They range from very small youth association with a couple hundred members in the universities to very large national faith-based Muslim community organization that was doing poverty reduction as well as HIV/AIDS. These are all organizations getting PEPFAR funding, by the way. Or network organizations, media network, or a network of organizations working with youth or just working on HIV/AIDS. For my doctoral dissertation, we're talking about systematic. I don't know whether you'd all see this as systematic, but the research was very qualitative, comparative multiple case studies, formal interviews, informal conversations, documented sources, reading material on the organizations, personal observation. I was an industry insider, so I was watching what was happening in two of these organizations, or maybe three, and a very multidisciplinary literature review with a lot of polyscience in it. In Côte d'Ivoire, I used something that was much more simple, a scoring tool that was carefully developed, which is a popular thing to use right now with organizational assessments, especially with PEPFAR. And I think, especially for the qualitative research, the researcher is very much the research tool. You know, I bring my own experience, which of course has its own biases, to what I'm doing, and I'm analyzing what's happening all the time. I'm trying to be an objective observer. Whether I am an objective observer or not, one can argue, but I try to be unbiased. This is very different than the systematic scoring tool. You know, with qualitative research, you have a very open-ended question usually and not a hypothesis you're testing because statistics tends to dominate public health, so this is very different. So I asked this very open-ended question: how is the development of foreign aid-dependent health sector organizations influenced by the foreign aid industry? Now, obviously, a lot of good things happen. Programs get funded, et cetera. So this is looking at something, other things, other than what the programs are actually doing. In the case of Côte d'Ivoire, I was looking at something much more simple and narrow. What is the capacity of each organization to plan and manage their finances? Basically, we have a fiduciary responsibility, so we want to make sure these organizations are going to be able to manage their money well. And this is an environment where there's a lot of graft and corruption, twice as bad as, say, Senegal or Ghana. This is a map of my multidisciplinary literature review, and the ultimate title of my dissertation was Foreign Aid and Neocolonialism, the Policies, Procedures, and Politics Influencing Foreign Aid-Dependent Organizations in Haiti and the Commonwealth Caribbean. So maybe I came to this with a bias 10 years later. This is just one page of the scoring tool that we used in Côte d'Ivoire. It was about 12 pages long, where we are looking at a number of criteria in financial management and planning and scoring these organizations in terms of where they are in their development. Although I liked this tool a lot and was involved in its development, I'm not a big believer in pigeonholing. I think it's a very useful way to give us a framework to think about what we're doing. But if you look at all those forms that I filled out with a colleague and how I checked them, and you read the 40-page document that is my observations on these organizations, it's very qualitative, you will learn much more about the organizations and their financial management and planning than you will from that pigeonholing scoring tool. So I have this quote from Einstein I like to use. Everything that can be counted does not necessarily count. I think we count way too much in this industry. And everything that counts cannot necessarily be counted or pigeonholed. Another framework that I use or lens to look at these organizations is to think about how the dynamics within them differ from a standard private sector organization. You know, if I'm running a coffee shop, I have the clients who pay me directly for the coffee or the sweets, etc. This isn't exclusively true to nonprofits, but it happens in private companies also. But in a nonprofit organization, you've got two very different sets of clients. You've got the funding clients who are paying your bills, including your own salary, if that's where you work, and you've got the recipient clients for whom you are supposed to be delivering a service or maybe some products. And when I first started my dissertation, I was trying to look at the tensions between these two. And I finally had to change my question because everybody was talking all the time about the funding clients and not the recipient clients. So the recipient clients are receiving some benefit from the goods and services provided, but they don't pay the full costs. They may pay some portion, but they represent the reason the organization exists. The funding clients get no benefit from the goods and service, except maybe a sense of well-being for having supported them. And they pay for part or all of the costs of production. They also represent financial security, which is a huge incentive. So when I look at these donor-dependent organizations and the market exchange, what you see is the delivery of the goods and services is a lower organizational priority. That was definitely a finding I had. Unless it's explicitly tied to funding levels, whereas the flow of funds is a higher organizational priority because it represents security for the staff and the organization. So when managers and people have to make choices, which they often do, they're going to give a little more emphasis to the funding clients than they are to the service clients that represent their raison d'etre. Whoops. I struggled for a long time to figure out how to put all my data together, and I ultimately used metaphors, which was an idea I got from a book called Images of Organization that was a really very innovative book on management that changed a lot of thinking. So I'm not going to go into all three, four of the metaphors I used, but first one is organizations as organisms adapting to try to thrive and strive and survive in the foreign aid environment. And a couple of the organizations that I was studying died because of the end of the Cold War and how much America was supporting Latin America and the Caribbean. And others changed completely because of new trends, whether it was environmental health or HIV/AIDS. The one I'm focusing on more this morning is organizations as machines. Now, many organizations shouldn't be thought of as machines, but clinical service is a good example of a machine. You're producing standardized services like you would if you are in the Ford Motor Company, et cetera. It's very different from an advocacy organization that's trying to change public opinion or behavior change. So what I found in terms of looking at organizations using the metaphor of machines is that the donor-driven financial systems were a patchwork. Procurement and financial reporting, a lot of burden, complexity, and whose purposes were served, not the organizations. Interpretations and exceptions to rules, how rules were used as a form of control and power over these organizations. Very weak and inefficient administration because of them trying to respond to the donors. This is much more severe if you've got more than one donor, but you want more than one donor. Dependency and suppression of initiative. There are silver linings in this bureaucratic cloud, especially if you've got an organization that is a natural machine and works well with bureaucracy, and then you impose the bureaucracy on it, only one funding source. So I had at least one example where that did work well. A third metaphor, again, that I won't go into is organizations within a political system, sources and uses of power, how these organizations are a kind of dependency that neocolonialism is encouraged. this is some of my Caribbean colleagues love this slide. So ultimately, colonialism is a development strategy with the organizations at the mercy of the donor policies and trying to adapt. Struggling under imposed bureaucracy, relatively powerless compared to the donors, and the result is a kind of dependency and paternalism. Now I'm shifting from that over to the pre-award financial assessment. I assume I'm okay since, good. This is using the scoring tool in Côte d'Ivoire. So what we found, if we look at financial and accounting policies, not procedures, but policies, internal inconsistencies in policies to comply with donor requirements, they caused the organization to malfunction, inconsistent administration. All seven organizations needed consistent organizational-wide policies that were gradually documented based on their own internal policies, not a lot of ideas imposed by each project and each donor. The accounting and financial systems, a patchwork of many systems. This could be even with the same donor. One of the organizations, which was known for blackmail, among other things, was getting 85% of its money from five different PEPFAR sources. So all these different intermediaries are sending money down to it. And so each project is run as a kind of a patchwork accounting system. Which also is a great way to do more graft and corruption, by the way, that kind of complexity. So all seven needed consistent organizational-wide systems based on what was actually done systematically across the whole organization. Project-driven systems strengthening became a historic artifact. You know, I would have people show me a book that they used to use, their manual for some grant, and they would say, "We did this," but they put it aside after the grant was over because they only used it for that one grant because that grant or the project running it was concerned about their fiduciary role, and so they had a manual for what they wanted done and didn't try to integrate into an organizational approach. Donors hold all the trump cards, donor requirements that take precedence over local laws. We found all of this PEPFAR reporting happening, maybe biodata sheets for USAID completed, but five of the seven organizations weren't doing local payroll taxes for Côte d'Ivoire. Donor requirements take precedence over internationally recognized accounting standards. Not one single one of these organizations had ever declared a fiscal year. They couldn't tell me how much money they'd had the year before total. They would eventually give some guesses. So they just did this project reporting at the timing the project reporting was required. And no one had ever had an overall organizational audit of the organization. Paternalism and dependency, double standards for local and international organizations that undermine organizational development, no consistency in the treatment of indirect costs. Most people don't understand what they are. They aren't allowed with local organizations, or they're allowed at such a low level that it's meaningless. And that's not the way that organizations from the U.S., for example, are treated by the American government. Also, they'd all often had audits done of their projects, but the audits were done by the intermediary. The reports from these audits were never shared with them. No one had an audit. They just heard people talk about them, so they didn't really know what was said in them. The accounting and finance personnel were actually quite well qualified. They represented a really solid human resource base on which we could build. But the underlying causes of weaknesses in the financial policies and systems weren't being addressed. This project-driven approach, values even, the issue of corruption being endemic is not being addressed locally. In Cote d'Ivoire or in other contexts. And in fact, it's stuff that you get all the time in the hallways and conversations with people, but it doesn't go into writing. In fact, somebody who told us one of our NGOs was guilty of blackmail got into real trouble. I think he got his wrists slapped for that. Another issue is the day-to-day mechanics dominate. There is no attention paid to cost analysis in terms of services or products purchased. There's no attention paid to cost analysis of any outputs. And this is a missed opportunity because there's potential to market these local organizations as much more cost-effective than international agencies, but they're not even coming close to thinking about that. Financial planning is often seen as a matter of faith. I'm at the end here. There needs to be a lot of advocacy around this, both the NGOs working together and other people working to look at what are the underlying incentives, what makes things tick, because we often look at the mechanics and we're not really dealing with what are the underlying incentives and why things are or aren't working. Thank you.
Well, we can take questions now for Maggie, if there's anything.
Not so much a question, but a comment. I happen to be local, and this past summer we had this event called the Biennial of the Americas, and they had a pretty interesting roundtable with people from all over the hemisphere. And a woman from Haiti, who had been a mayor, and now she's a fellow at some organization here in the U.S., and I'm so sorry, email it to you, but she made a point in the poverty panel that right now, NGOs are learning. She said, you need to help us do it on our own, don't do it for us. And when you started your talk, I need to give you her name, because you definitely need to know each other.
Thank you. Yes?
I think your findings are what people who have direct experience in any of these organizations would probably agree with, that they were allowed to think independently. I'm curious, how do you see trying to change this kind of system that some people call it an NGOcracy or philanthropocracy? You are beholden to the funders, and that's the main thing you do.
When I've had the privilege of being able to work inside one of these organizations and talk to them about this, I find if you've got an intelligent funding client that you can talk to and explain things to, then they learn themselves how to deal with the foreign aid bureaucracy. It's them having the self-confidence to speak up because they know what's going wrong and recognize that if you've got an intelligent client who's also confident, and I'm talking about the funding client, then you can explain that if we do it this way, things won't work as well. You know, if you really want sustainability, if you want stronger organizations, et cetera, and if you want, also if you want vibrant civil society organizations, there's an interesting doctoral dissertation that somebody in California did about 15 years ago that studies the development of IPPF and how it went from being a really grassroots advocacy change agent in the world to being this slow-moving bureaucracy that's rather inept. And her main explanation is it was imposed bureaucracy by donor agencies, especially USAID. But I speak about it, but it doesn't, you know, I don't know that our client, funding client in Cote d'Ivoire will be so happy if they watch this presentation, even though I understand the Obama administration is looking for failures.
Thank you very much. I found it very interesting. I felt some of the obvious things that I could think of you didn't refer to, and I wonder whether that's implicit or coming through the whole thing, and that the political implications or political aspects of it, that the way, so I'm actually less worried about the bureaucratization, which is just a pain, I think, but what it reflects, and it reflects the fundamental disrespect for local systems, and I would even go further than you do, we have been, or we are, instrumentalizing civil society in poor countries for our own purposes, for our own agendas, and thereby we not only undermine civil society, but more importantly, we also undermine the social contract between citizens and their governments. Now, of course, granted, many of these governments don't feel that kind of responsibility, but it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I sense that somehow a respect, and that's kind of a system thing, that there is a whole government system in place in countries. While we usually, or in this industry, when we think of countries, we immediately go to community level, and we think of communities as the beneficiaries. And I think adding that systems agenda at a local level is for complicating things, but I don't see any way around it, but not for kind of bureaucratic or proper financial management kind of reasons, but more for the reasons of political legitimacy, sovereignty, and also if that's important for people because we know it works better and is more sustainable. But I think actually political might be more important. So the question is, how can we add another systems layer, the most critical one, if you ask me, to something that is more than just a blind spot, it's almost like a systematic disrespect for those kinds of...
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I've focused here this morning on this one metaphor about machines, but I had the organizations as organisms deals with that much more, and you can look in Cote d'Ivoire, including at some of the influences programmatically, for example, of PEPFAR on, how we teach HIV/AIDS to youth, for example, and whether we talk to anybody under the age of 15 about anything other than abstinence. I mean, there's a lot of... And last week in Canada, there was a big debate about Haiti as the NGO republic. You know, what are we doing there? And also whether we're undermining the development of government in some countries when we, so heavily support civil society. And whether it really is vibrant civil society or just donor-dependent organizations.
So, do you have a grassroots idea for how we should do this advocacy?
I think we were there with drugs yesterday talking about how we should do, what we should do about the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah, I think that more people have to speak up about this. I don't hear much discussion. We do a lot of self-serving promotion in conferences where we talk about our success stories, and that the system motivates us to do that. You know, we are in competition for funding, and so we stand up and say, ta-da, we've done this, and I do it too. I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. And I think we also don't look below the surface at what actually is provoking the behavior, what makes things tip. Malcolm?
The Global Health Initiative, in some measure, is supposed to address this in terms of country ownership, except that none of us actually know what country ownership means. Have you got any thoughts on that in relation to what we found?
Well, to me, a lot of this is just ironic. It's the same, you know, I'm getting questions about how we're dealing with gender in Côte d'Ivoire when we do our country operating plan. At the same time, yesterday, I made a presentation on virginity and the fact that we were funding virginity contests in Côte d'Ivoire. Now, you know, I find a contradiction between that and gender equity. So, the country ownership, well, we're busy telling them what to do. I just don't see it happening. It seems like empty language. I certainly don't have answers. Bonnie?
We should probably fold the rest of the questions.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's some experience in Latin America in health sector reform, like trying to change that kind of that diagram where, so that there's citizen panels in the major clinics, you know, that really so it's a governance accountability mechanism so that the services actually are more accountable to the users. And so I'm wondering whether health system strengthening that you're familiar with in the Caribbean or, you know, in particular is kind of looking at mechanisms like that or, you know, there's any.
Well, that's a good point for a lot of these organizations. If we actually focused more on doing the kind of thing the commercial sector would do, where we're doing market surveys to see if the consumers are really happy and judging the organizations on the basis of how happy the consumer is with their services. Yeah, it could certainly work for family planning, reproductive health issues.
Thank you so much. You can have further questions at the end of the rest of the presentations. I must also add that there may be ways in which tools from systems thinking can diagram some of these relationships and perhaps provide harder evidence of how these relationships damage the intended consequences.